This is disc number 3.
Either Stillman knew what he was doing or he didn't. And if he didn't, then Quinn was going nowhere, was wasting his time. How much better it was to believe that all his steps were actually to some purpose. If this interpretation required knowledge on Stillman's part, then Quinn would accept this knowledge as an article of faith, at least for the time being. There remained the problem of how to occupy his thoughts as he followed the old man. Quinn was used to wandering. His excursions through the city had taught him to understand the connectedness of inner and outer. Using aimless motion as a technique of reversal, on his best days he could bring the outside in and thus usurp the sovereignty of inwardness. By flooding himself with externals, by drowning himself out of himself, he had managed to exert some small degree of control over his fits of despair. Wandering, therefore, was a kind of mindlessness. But following Stillman was not wandering. Stillman could wander. He could stagger like a blind man from one spot to another, but this was a privilege denied to Quinn, for he was obliged now to concentrate on what he was doing, even if it was next to nothing. Time and again, his thoughts would begin to drift, and soon thereafter his steps would follow suit. This meant that he was constantly in danger of quickening his pace and crashing into Stillman from behind. To guard against this mishap, he devised several different methods of deceleration. The first was to tell himself that he was no longer Daniel Quinn. He was Paul Auster now. And with each step he took, he tried to fit more comfortably into the strictures of that transformation. Auster was no more than a name to him, a husk without content. To be Auster meant being a man with no interior, a man with no thoughts. And if there were no thoughts available to him, if his own inner life had been made inaccessible, then there was no place for him to retreat to. As Auster, he could not summon up any memories or fears, any dreams or joys, for all these things, as they pertain to Auster, were a blank to him. He consequently had to remain solely on his own surface, looking outward for sustenance. To keep his eyes fixed on Stillman, therefore, was not merely a distraction from the train of his thoughts, it was the only thought he allowed himself to have. For a day or two, this tactic was mildly successful, but eventually even Auster began to droop from the monotony. Quinn realized that he needed something more to keep himself occupied, some little task to accompany him as he went about his work. In the end, it was the red notebook that offered him salvation. Instead of merely jotting down a few casual comments, as he had done the first few days, he decided to record every detail about Stillman he possibly could. Using the pen he had bought from the deaf mute, he set about his task with diligence. Not only did he take note of Stillman's gestures, describe each object he selected or rejected for his bag, and keep an accurate timetable for all events, but he also set down with meticulous care an exact itinerary of Stillman's divagations, noting each street he followed, each turn he made, and each pause that occurred. In addition to keeping him busy, the red notebook slowed Quinn's pace. There was no danger now of overtaking Stillman. The problem, rather, was to keep up with him, to make sure he did not vanish. For walking and writing were not easily compatible activities. If for the past 5 years Quinn had spent his days doing the one and the other, now he was trying to do them both at the same time. In the beginning, he made many mistakes. It was especially difficult to write without looking at the page, and he often discovered that he had written two or even three lines on top of each other, producing a jumbled, illegible palimpsest. To look at the page, however, meant stopping, and this would increase his chances of losing Stillman. After a time, he decided that it was basically a question of position. He experimented with the notebook in front of him at a 45-degree angle, but he found his left wrist soon tired. After that, he tried keeping the notebook directly in front of his face, eyes peering over it like some Kilroy come to life, but this proved impractical. Next, he tried propping the notebook on his right arm, several inches above his elbow, and supporting the back of the notebook with his left palm. But this cramped his writing hand and made writing on the bottom half of the page impossible. Finally, he decided to rest the notebook on his left hip, much as an artist holds his palette. This was an improvement. The carrying no longer caused a strain, and his right hand could hold the pen unencumbered by other duties. Although this method also had its drawbacks, it seemed to be the most comfortable arrangement over the long haul. For Quinn was now able to divide his attention almost equally between Stillman and his writing, glancing now up at the one, now down at the other, seeing the thing and writing about it in the same fluid gesture. With the deaf-mute's pen in his right hand and the red notebook on his left hip, Quinn went on following Stillman for another 9 days. His nightly conversations with Virginia Stillman were brief. Although the memory of the kiss was still sharp in Quinn's mind, there had been no further romantic developments. At first, Quinn had expected something to happen. After such a promising start, he felt certain that he would eventually find Mrs. Stillman in his arms. But his employer had rapidly retreated behind the mask of business, and not once had referred to that isolated moment of passion. Perhaps Quinn had been misguided in his hopes, momentarily confusing himself with Max Work, a man who never failed to profit from such situations. Or perhaps it was simply that Quinn was beginning to feel his loneliness more keenly. It had been a long time since a warm body had been beside him. For the fact was, he had started lusting after Virginia Stillman the moment he saw her, well before the kiss took place. Nor did her current lack of encouragement prevent him from continuing to imagine her naked. Lascivious pictures marched through Quinn's head each night, and although the chances of their becoming real seemed remote, they remained a pleasant diversion. Much later, long after it was too late, he realized that deep inside he had been nurturing the chivalric hope of solving the case so brilliantly, of removing Peter Stillman from danger so swiftly and irrevocably that he would win Mrs. Stillman's desire for as long as he wanted it. That, of course, was a mistake. But of all the mistakes Quinn made from beginning to end, it was no worse than any other. It was the 13th day since the case had begun. Quinn returned home that evening out of sorts. He was discouraged, ready to abandon ship. In spite of the games he had been playing with himself, in spite of the stories he had made up to keep himself going, there seemed to be no substance to the case. Stillman was a crazy old man who had forgotten his son. He could be followed to the end of time, and still nothing would happen. Quinn picked up the phone and dialed the Stillman apartment.
"I'm about ready to pack it in," he said to Virginia Stillman. "From all I've seen, there's no threat to Peter."
"That's just what he wants us to think," the woman answered. "You have no idea how clever he is, and how patient."
"He might be patient, but I'm not. I think you're wasting your money, and I'm wasting my time."
"Are you sure he hasn't seen you? That could make all the difference."
"I wouldn't stake my life on it, but yes, I'm sure."
"What are you saying, then?"
"I'm saying you have nothing to worry about, at least for now. If anything happens later, contact me. I'll come running at the first sign of trouble."
After a pause, Virginia Stillman said, "You could be right." Then after another pause, "But just to reassure me a little, I wonder if we could compromise?"
"It depends on what you have in mind."
"Just this. Give it a few more days to make absolutely certain."
"On one condition," said Quinn. "You've got to let me do it my own way. No more restraints. I have to be free to talk to him, to question him, to get to the bottom of it once and for all."
"Wouldn't that be risky?"
"You don't have to worry. I'm not going to tip our hand. He won't even guess who I am or what I'm up to."
How will you manage that?
That's my problem. I have all kinds of tricks up my sleeve. You just have to trust me.
All right, I'll go along. I don't suppose it will hurt?
Good. I'll give it a few more days, and then we'll see where we stand.
Mr. Oster?
Yes?
I'm terribly grateful. Peter has been in such good shape these past 2 weeks, and I know it's because of you. He talks about you all the time. You're like, I don't know, a hero to him.
And how does Mrs. Stillman feel?
She feels much the same way.
That's good to hear. Maybe someday she'll allow me to feel grateful to her.
Anything is possible, Mr. Oster. You should remember that.
I will. I'd be a fool not to.
Quinn made a light supper of scrambled eggs and toast, drank a bottle of beer, and then settled down at his desk with the red notebook. He had been writing in it now for many days, filling page after page with his erratic, jostled hand, but he had not yet had the heart to read over what he had written. Now that the end at last seemed in sight, he thought he might hazard a look. Much of it was hard going, especially in the early parts, and when he did manage to decipher the words, it did not seem to have been worth the trouble. Picks up pencil in middle of block, examines, hesitates, puts in bag, buys sandwich in deli, sits on bench in park and reads through red notebook. These sentences seemed utterly worthless to him. It was all a question of method. If the object was to understand Stillman, to get to know him well enough to be able to anticipate what he would do next, Quinn had failed. He had started with a limited set of facts, Stillman's background and profession, the imprisonment of his son, his arrest and hospitalization, a book of bizarre scholarship written while he was supposedly still sane, and above all, Virginia Stillman's certainty that he would now try to harm his son. But the facts of the past seemed to have no bearing on the facts of the present. Quinn was deeply disillusioned. He had always imagined that the key to good detective work was a close observation of details. The more accurate the scrutiny, the more successful the results. The implication was that human behavior could be understood, that beneath the infinite facade of gestures, ticks, and silences, there was finally a coherence, an order, a source of motivation. But after struggling to take in all these surface effects, Quinn felt no closer to Stillman than when he first started following him. He had lived Stillman's life, walked at his pace, seen what he had seen, and the only thing he felt now was the man's impenetrability. Instead of narrowing the distance that lay between him and Stillman, he had seen the old man slip away from him, even as he remained before his eyes. For no particular reason that he was aware of, Quinn turned to a clean page of the red notebook and sketched a little map of the area Stillman had wandered in. Then, looking carefully through his notes, he began to trace with his pen the movements Stillman had made on a single day. The first day, he had kept a full record of the old man's wanderings. Quinn was struck by the way Stillman had skirted around the edge of the territory, not once venturing into the center. The diagram looked a little like a map of some imaginary state in the Midwest. Except for the 11 blocks up Broadway at the start and the series of curlicues that represented Stillman's meanderings in Riverside Park, the picture also resembled a rectangle. On the other hand, given the quadrant structure of New York streets, it might also have been a zero or the letter O. Quinn went on to the next day and decided to see what would happen. The results were not at all the same. This picture made Quinn think of a bird of prey, perhaps, with its wings spread, hovering aloft in the air. A moment later, this reading seemed far-fetched to him. The bird vanished, and in its stead, there were only two abstract shapes, linked by the tiny bridge Stillman had formed by walking west on 83rd Street. Quinn paused for a moment to ponder what he was doing. Was he scribbling nonsense? Was he feeble-mindedly frittering away the evening, or was he trying to find something? Either response, he realized, was unacceptable. If he was simply killing time, why had he chosen such a painstaking way to do it? Was he so muddled that he no longer had the courage to think? On the other hand, if he was not merely diverting himself, what was he actually up to? It seemed to him that he was looking for a sign. He was ransacking the chaos of Stillman's movements for some glimmer of cogency. This implied only one thing, that he continued to disbelieve the arbitrariness of Stillman's actions. He wanted there to be a sense to them, no matter how obscure. This, in itself, was unacceptable, for it meant that Quinn was allowing himself to deny the facts, and this, as he well knew, was the worst thing a detective could do. Nevertheless, he decided to go on with it. It was not late, not even 11 o'clock yet, and the truth was that it could do no harm. The results of the third map bore no resemblance to the other two. There no longer seemed to be a question about what was happening. If he discounted the squiggles from the park, Quinn felt certain that he was looking at the letter E. Assuming the first diagram had in fact represented the letter O, then it seemed legitimate to assume that the bird wings of the second formed the letter W. Of course, the letters O-W-E spelled a word, but Quinn was not ready to draw any conclusions. He had not begun his inventory until the fifth day of Stillman's travels, and the identities of the first four letters were anyone's guess. He regretted not having started sooner, knowing now that the mystery of those 4 days was irretrievable. But perhaps he would be able to make up for the past by plunging forward. By coming to the end, perhaps he could intuit the beginning. The next day's diagram seemed to yield a shape that resembled the letter R. As with the others, it was complicated by numerous irregularities, approximations, and ornate embellishments in the park. Still clinging to a semblance of objectivity, Quinn tried to look at it as if he had not been anticipating a letter of the alphabet. He had to admit that nothing was sure. It could well have been meaningless. Perhaps he was looking for pictures in the clouds, as he had done as a small boy. And yet the coincidence was too striking. If one map had resembled a letter, perhaps even two, he might have dismissed it as a quirk of chance, but 4 in a row was stretching it too far. The next day gave him a lopsided O, a donut crushed on one side with 3 or 4 jagged lines sticking out the other. Then came a tidy F, with the customary Rococo swirls to the side. After that, there was a B that looked like 2 boxes haphazardly placed on top of one another, with packing excelsior brimming over the edges. Next, there was a tottering A that somewhat resembled a ladder, with graded steps on each side. And finally, there was a second B, precariously tilted on a perverse single point like an upside-down pyramid. Quinn then copied out the letters in order. O-W-E-R-O-F-B-A-B. After fiddling with them for 1/4 hour, switching them around, pulling them apart, rearranging the sequence, he returned to the original order and wrote them out in the following manner. Hour of Bab. The solution seemed so grotesque that his nerve almost failed him. Making all due allowances for the fact that he had missed the first 4 days and that Stillman had not yet finished, the answer seemed inescapable. The Tower of Babel. Quinn's thoughts momentarily flew off to the concluding pages of A. Gordon Pym and to the discovery of the strange hieroglyphs on the inner wall of the chasm, letters inscribed into the earth itself, as though they were trying to say something that could no longer be understood. But on second thought, this did not seem apt, for Stillman had not left his message anywhere. True, he had created the letters by the movement of his steps, but they had not been written down. It was like drawing a picture in the air with your finger. The image vanishes as you are making it. There is no result, no trace to mark what you have done. And yet the pictures did exist, not in the streets where they had been drawn, but in Quinn's red notebook. He wondered if Stillman had sat down each night in his room and plotted his course for the following day, or whether he had improvised as he had gone along. It was impossible to know. He also wondered what purpose this writing served in Stillman's mind. Was it merely some sort of note to himself, or was it intended as a message to others? At the very least, Quinn concluded, it meant that Stillman had not forgotten Henry Dark. Quinn did not want to panic. In an effort to restrain himself, he tried to imagine things in the worst possible light. By seeing the worst, perhaps it would not be as bad as he thought. He broke it down as follows. First, Stillman was indeed plotting something against Peter. Response, that had been the premise in any case. Second, Stillman had known he would be followed, had known his movements would be recorded, had known his message would be deciphered. Response, that did not change the essential fact that Peter had to be protected. Third, Stillman was far more dangerous than previously imagined. Response, that did not mean he could get away with it. This helped somewhat, but the letters continued to horrify Quinn. The whole thing was so oblique, so fiendish in its circumlocutions, that he did not want to accept it. Then doubts came, as if on command, filling his head with mocking, sing-song voices. He had imagined the whole thing. The letters were not letters at all. He had seen them only because he had wanted to see them. And even if the diagrams did form letters, it was only a fluke. Stillman had nothing to do with it. It was all an accident, a hoax he had perpetrated on himself. He decided to go to bed, slept fitfully, woke up, wrote in the red notebook for half an hour, went back to bed. His last thought before he went to sleep was that he probably had two more days, since Stillman had not yet completed his message. The last two letters remained, the E and the L. Quinn's mind dispersed. He arrived in a neverland of fragments, a place of wordless things and thingless words. Then, struggling through his torpor one last time, he told himself that El was the ancient Hebrew for God. In his dream, which he later forgot, he found himself in the town dump of his childhood, sifting through a mountain of rubbish. Chapter 9. The first meeting with Stillman took place in Riverside Park. It was mid-afternoon, a Saturday of bicycles, dog walkers, and children. Stillman was sitting alone on a bench, staring out at nothing in particular, the little red notebook on his lap. There was light everywhere, an immense light that seemed to radiate outward from each thing the eye caught hold of, and overhead, in the branches of the trees, a breeze continued to blow, shaking the leaves with a passionate hissing, a rising and falling that breathed on as steadily as surf. Quinn had planned his moves carefully. Pretending not to notice Stillman, he sat down on the bench beside him, folded his arms across his chest, and stared out in the same direction as the old man. Neither of them spoke. By his later calculations, Quinn estimated that this went on for 15 or 20 minutes. Then, without warning, he turned his head toward the old man and looked at him point blank, stubbornly fixing his eyes on the wrinkled profile. Quinn concentrated all his strength in his eyes, as if they could begin to burn a hole in Stillman's skull. This stare went on for 5 minutes. At last, Stillman turned to him. In a surprisingly gentle tenor voice, he said, "I'm sorry, but it won't be possible for me to talk to you."
"I haven't said anything," said Quinn.
"That's true," said Stillman, "but you must understand that I'm not in the habit of talking to strangers."
"I repeat," said Quinn, That I haven't said anything.
Yes, I heard you the first time, but aren't you interested in knowing why?
I'm afraid not.
Well put. I can see you're a man of sense. Quinn shrugged, refusing to respond. His whole being now exuded indifference. Stillman smiled brightly at this, leaned toward Quinn, and said in a conspiratorial voice, I think we are going to get along.
That remains to be seen, said Quinn, after a long pause.
Stillman laughed, a brief booming haw, and then continued, It's not that I dislike strangers per se. It's just that I prefer not to speak to anyone who does not introduce himself. In order to begin, I must have a name.
But once a man gives you his name, he's no longer a stranger.
Exactly. That's why I never talk to strangers. Quinn had been prepared for this and knew how to answer. He was not going to let himself be caught. Since he was technically Paul Auster, that was the name he had to protect. Anything else, even the truth, would be an invention, a mask to hide behind and keep him safe.
In that case, he said, I'm happy to oblige you. My name is Quinn.
Ah, said Stillman reflectively, nodding his head. Quinn.
Yes, Quinn. Q-U-I-N-N.
I see. Yes, yes, I see. Quinn. Yes. Very interesting. Quinn. A most resonant word. Rhymes with twin, does it not?
That's right, twin.
And sin, too, if I'm not mistaken.
You're not.
And also in, one N, or in, two. Isn't that so?
Exactly.
Very interesting. I see many possibilities for this word, this quin, this quintessence of quiddity. Quick, for example, and quill, and quack, and quirk. Rhymes with grin, not to speak of kin. Very interesting. And win, and fin, and din, and gin, and pin, and tin, and bin. Even rhymes with gin. And if you say it right, with bin. Yes, very interesting. I like your name enormously, Mr. Quinn. It flies off in so many little directions at once.
Yes, I've often noticed that myself.
Most people don't pay attention to such things. They think of words as stones, as great unmovable objects with no life, as monads that never change.
Stones can change. They can be worn away by wind or water. They can erode. They can be crushed. You can turn them into shards or gravel or dust.
Exactly. I could tell you were a man of sense right away, Mr. Quinn. If you only knew how many people have misunderstood me. My work has suffered because of it, suffered terribly.
Your work?
Yes, my work. My projects, my investigations, my experiments.
Ah,
yes, but in spite of all the setbacks, I have never really been daunted. At present, for example, I am engaged in one of the most important things I have ever done. If all goes well, I believe I will hold the key to a series of major discoveries.
The key?
Yes, the key. A thing that opens locked doors.
Ah.
Of course, for the time being, I'm merely collecting data, gathering evidence, so to speak. Then I will have to coordinate my findings. It's highly demanding work. You wouldn't believe how hard, especially for a man of my age.
I can imagine.
That's right. There's so much to do and so little time to do it. Every morning, I get up at dawn. I have to be outside in all kinds of weather, constantly on the move, forever on my feet, going from one place to the next. It wears me out, you can be sure of that.
But it's worth it.
Anything for the truth. No sacrifice is too great.
Indeed.
You see, no one has understood what I have understood. I'm the first. I'm the only one. It puts a great burden of responsibility on me. the world on your shoulders. Yes, so to speak, the world, or what is left of it. I hadn't realized it was as bad as that. It's that bad, maybe even worse. Ah, you see, the world is in fragments, sir, and it's my job to put it back together again. You've taken on quite a bit. I realize that, but I'm merely looking for the principle. That's well within the scope of one man. If I can lay the foundation, other hands can do the work of restoration itself. The important thing is the premise, the theoretical first step. Unfortunately, there is no one else who can do this. Have you made much progress? Enormous strides. In fact, I feel now that I'm on the verge of a significant breakthrough. I'm reassured to hear it. It's a comforting thought, yes, and it's all because of my cleverness, the dazzling clarity of my mind. I don't doubt it. You see, I've understood the need to limit myself, to work within a terrain small enough to make all results conclusive. The premise of the premise, so to speak. That's it exactly. The principle of the principle, the method of operation. You see, the world is in fragments, sir. Not only have we lost our sense of purpose, we have lost the language whereby we can speak of it. These are no doubt spiritual matters, but they have their analog in the material world. My brilliant stroke has been to confine myself to physical things, to the immediate and tangible. My motives are lofty, but my work now takes place in the realm of the everyday. That's why I'm so often misunderstood. But no matter, I've learned to shrug these things off. An admirable response. The only response. The only one worthy of a man of my stature. You see, I am in the process of inventing a new language. With work such as that to do, I can't be bothered by the stupidity of others. In any case, it's all part of the disease I'm trying to cure. A new language? Yes, a language that will at last say what we have to say. For our words no longer correspond to the world. When things were whole, we felt confident that our words could express them. But little by little, these things have broken apart, shattered, collapsed into chaos. And yet our words have remained the same. They have not adapted themselves to the new reality. Hence, every time we try to speak of what we see, we speak falsely, distorting the very thing we are trying to represent. It's made a mess of everything. But words, as you yourself understand, are capable of change. The problem is how to demonstrate this. That is why I now work with the simplest means possible. So simple that even a child can grasp what I am saying. Consider a word that refers to a thing. Umbrella, for example. When I say the word umbrella, you see the object in your mind. You see a kind of stick with collapsible metal spokes on top that form an armature for a waterproof material which, when opened, will protect you from the rain. This last detail is important. Not only is an umbrella a thing, it is a thing that performs a function. In other words, expresses the will of man. When you stop to think of it, every object is similar to the umbrella, in that it serves a function. A pencil is for writing, a shoe is for wearing, a car is for driving. Now, my question is this. What happens when a thing no longer performs its function? Is it still the thing, or has it become something else? When you rip the cloth off the umbrella, is the umbrella still an umbrella? You open the spokes, put them over your head, walk out into the rain, and you get drenched. Is it possible to go on calling this object an umbrella? In general, people do. At the very limit, they will say the umbrella is broken. To me, this is a serious error. The source of all our troubles. Because it can no longer perform its function, the umbrella has ceased to be an umbrella. It might resemble an umbrella, it might once have been an umbrella, but now it has changed into something else. The word, however, has remained the same. Therefore, it can no longer express the thing. It is imprecise. It is false. It hides the thing it is supposed to reveal. And if we cannot even name a common, everyday object that we hold in our hands, how can we expect to speak of the things that truly concern us? Unless we can begin to embody the notion of change in the words we use, we will continue to be lost.
And your work?
My work is very simple. I have come to New York because it is the most forlorn of places, the most abject. The brokenness is everywhere. The disarray is universal. You have only to open your eyes to see it. The broken people, the broken things, the broken thoughts. The whole city is a junk heap. It suits my purpose admirably. I find the streets an endless source of material, an inexhaustible storehouse of shattered things. Each day I go out with my bag and collect objects that seem worthy of investigation. My samples now number in the hundreds, from the chipped to the smashed, from the dented to the squashed, from the pulverized to the putrid.
What do you do with these things?
I give them names.
Names?
I invent new words that will correspond to the things.
Ah, now I see. But how do you decide? How do you know if you've found the right word?
I never make a mistake. It's a function of my genius.
Could you give me an example?
Of one of my words?
Yes.
I'm sorry, but that won't be possible. It's my secret, you understand. Once I've published my book, you and the rest of the world will know. But for now, I have to keep it to myself.
Classified information.
That's right. Top secret.
I'm sorry.
You shouldn't be too disappointed. It won't be long now before I put my findings in order. Then great things will begin to happen. It will be the most important event in the history of mankind.
The second meeting took place a little past 9 o'clock the following morning. It was Sunday, and Stillman had emerged from the hotel an hour later than usual. He walked the 2 blocks to his customary breakfast place, the Mayflower Cafe, and sat down in a corner booth at the back. Quinn, growing bolder now, followed the old man into the restaurant and sat down in the same booth, directly opposite him. For a minute or two, Stillman seemed not to notice his presence. Then, looking up from his menu, he studied Quinn's face in an abstract sort of way. He apparently did not recognize him from the day before.
"Do I know you?"
he asked. "I don't think so," said Quinn. "My name is Henry Dark."
"Ah,"
Stillman nodded. "A man who begins with the essential. I like that." "I'm not one to beat around the bush," said Quinn. "The bush? What bush might that be?" "The burning bush, of course."
"Ah, yes, the burning bush, of course."
Stillman looked at Quinn's face, a little more carefully now, but also with what seemed to be a certain confusion.
"I'm sorry," he went on, "but I don't remember your name. I recall that you gave it to me not long ago, but now it seems to be gone."
"Henry Dark," said Quinn.
"So it is. Yes, now it comes back to me. Henry Dark."
Stillman paused for a long moment and then shook his head.
"Unfortunately, that's not possible, sir."
"Why not?"
"Because there is no Henry Dark."
"Well, perhaps I'm another Henry Dark, as opposed to the one who doesn't exist."
Yes, I see your point. It is true that two people sometimes have the same name. It's quite possible that your name is Henry Dark, but you're not the Henry Dark."
"Is he a friend of yours?"
Stillman laughed, as if at a good joke. "Not exactly," he said. "You see, there never was any such person as Henry Dark. I made him up. He's an invention."
"No," said Quinn, with feigned disbelief.
"Yes, he's a character in a book I once wrote, a figment." I find that hard to accept. So did everyone else. I fooled them all.
Amazing. Why in the world did you do it?
I needed him, you see. I had certain ideas at the time that were too dangerous and controversial. So I pretended they had come from someone else. It was a way of protecting myself.
How did you decide on the name Henry Dark?
It's a good name, don't you think? I like it very much. Full of mystery, and at the same time quite proper. It suited my purpose well, and besides, it had a secret meaning.
The allusion to darkness?
No, nothing so obvious. It was the initials, HD. That was very important.
How so?
Don't you want to guess?
I don't think so.
Oh, do try. Make 3 guesses. If you don't get it, then I'll tell you.
Quinn paused for a moment, trying to give it his best effort. HD, he said. For Henry David? As in Henry David Thoreau?
Not even close.
How about HD Pure and Simple for the poet Hilda Doolittle?
Worse than the first one.
All right, one more guess. HD. H and D. Just a moment. How about... Just a moment. Ah, yes, here we are.
H for the weeping philosopher Heraclitus, and D for the laughing philosopher Democritus. Heraclitus and Democritus, the 2 poles of the dialectic. A very clever answer.
Am I right?
No, of course not, but a clever answer just the same.
You can't say I didn't try.
No, I can't. That's why I'm going to reward you with the correct answer, because you tried. Are you ready?
Ready.
The initials HD in the name Henry Dark refer to Humpty Dumpty.
Who?
Humpty Dumpty. You know who I mean, the egg.
As in Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall?
Exactly.
I don't understand.
Humpty Dumpty, the purest embodiment of the human condition.
Listen carefully, sir.
What is an egg? It is that which has not yet been born. A paradox, is it not? For how can Humpty Dumpty be alive if he has not been born? And yet he is alive. Make no mistake, we know that because he can speak. More than that, he is a philosopher of language. When I use a word, Humpty Dumpty said in rather a scornful tone, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. The question is, said Alice, whether you can make words mean so many different things. The question is, said Humpty Dumpty, which is to be master. That's all.
Lewis Carroll.
Through the Looking Glass. Chapter 6.
Interesting.
It's more than interesting, sir. It's crucial. Listen carefully and perhaps you will learn something. In his little speech to Alice, Humpty Dumpty sketches the future of human hopes and gives the clue to our salvation. To become masters of the words we speak, to make language answer our needs. Humpty Dumpty was a prophet. A man who spoke truths the world was not ready for.
A man?
Excuse me, a slip of the tongue, I mean an egg. But the slip is instructive and helps to prove my point. For all men are eggs, in a manner of speaking. We exist, but we have not yet achieved the form that is our destiny. We are pure potential, an example of the not yet arrived. For man is a fallen creature. We know that from Genesis. Humpty Dumpty is also a fallen creature. He falls from his wall, and no one can put him back together again. Neither the king, nor his horses, nor his men. But that is what we must all now strive to do. It is our duty as human beings to put the egg back together again. For each of us, sir, is Humpty Dumpty, and to help him is to help ourselves.
A convincing argument.
It's impossible to find a flaw in it.
No cracks in the egg.
Exactly. and at the same time the origin of Henry Dark.
Yes, but there is more to it than that. Another egg, in fact.
There's more than one?
Good heavens, yes, there are millions of them, but the one I have in mind is particularly famous. It's probably the most celebrated egg of all.
You're beginning to lose me.
I'm speaking of Columbus's egg.
Ah, yes, of course. You know the story? Everyone does.
It's charming, is it not? When faced with the problem of how to stand an egg on its end, he merely tapped slightly on the bottom, cracking the shell just enough to create a certain flatness that would support the egg when he removed his hand.
It worked.
Of course, it worked. Columbus was a genius. He sought paradise and discovered the new world.
It is still not too late for it to become paradise.
Indeed.
I admit that things have not worked out too well yet, but there is still hope. Americans have never lost their desire to discover new worlds.
Do you remember what happened in 1969?
I remember many things. What do you have in mind?
Men walked on the moon. Think of that, dear sir. Men walked on the moon.
Yes, I remember. According to the president, it was the greatest event since creation.
He was right, the only intelligent thing that man ever said.
And what do you suppose the moon looks like?
I have no idea.
Come, come, think again.
Oh, yes.
Now I see what you mean.
Granted, the resemblance is not perfect, but it is true that in certain phases, especially on a clear night, the moon does look very much like an egg.
Yes, very much like.
At that moment, a waitress appeared with Stillman's breakfast and set it on the table before him. The old man eyed the food with relish. Decorously lifting a knife with his right hand, he cracked the shell of his soft-boiled egg and said, "As you can see, sir, I leave no stone unturned." The third meeting took place later that same day. The afternoon was well advanced, the light like gauze on the bricks and leaves, the shadows lengthening. Once again, Stillman retreated to Riverside Park, this time to the edge of it, coming to rest on a knobby outcrop at 84th Street known as Mount Tom. On this same spot, in the summers of 1843 and 1844, Edgar Allan Poe had spent many long hours gazing out at the Hudson. Quinn knew this because he had made it his business to know such things. As it turned out, he had often sat there himself. He felt little fear now about doing what he had to do. He circled the rock two or three times, but failed to get Stillman's attention. Then he sat down next to the old man and said hello. Incredibly, Stillman did not recognize him. This was the third time Quinn had presented himself, and each time it was as though Quinn had been someone else. He could not decide whether this was a good sign or bad. If Stillman was pretending, he was an actor like no other in the world. For each time Quinn had appeared, he had done it by surprise, and yet Stillman had not even blinked. On the other hand, if Stillman really did not recognize him, what did this mean? Was it possible for anyone to be so impervious to the things he saw? The old man asked him who he was.
"My name is Peter Stillman," said Quinn.
"That's my name," answered Stillman. "I'm Peter Stillman."
"I'm the other Peter Stillman," said Quinn.
"Oh, you mean my son. Yes, that's possible. You look just like him. Of course, Peter is blonde and you are dark. Not Henry Dark, but dark of hair. But people change, don't they? One minute we're one thing and then another another."
"Exactly.
I've often wondered about you, Peter. Many times I've thought to myself, I wonder how Peter is getting along."
"I'm much better now, thank you."
"I'm glad to hear it. Someone once told me you had died. It made me very sad."
No, I've made a complete recovery. I can see that. Fit as a fiddle. And you speak so well, too. All words are available to me now, even the ones most people have trouble with. I can say them all. I'm proud of you, Peeta. I owe it all to you. Children are a great blessing. I've always said that, an incomparable blessing. I'm sure of it. As for me, I have my good days and my bad days. When the bad days come, I think of the ones that were good. Memory is a great blessing, Peeta. The next best thing to death.
Without a doubt. Of course, we must live in the present, too. For example, I am currently in New York. Tomorrow, I could be somewhere else. I travel a great deal, you see. Here today, gone tomorrow. It's part of my work.
It must be stimulating.
Yes, I'm very stimulated. My mind never stops.
That's good to hear.
The years weigh heavily, it's true, but we have so much to be thankful for. Time makes us grow old, but it also gives us the day and the night, and when we die, there is always someone to take our place.
We all grow old.
When you're old, perhaps you'll have a son to comfort you.
I would like that.
Then you would be as fortunate as I have been. Remember, Peeta, children are a great blessing.
I won't forget.
And remember, too, that you shouldn't put all your eggs in one basket. Conversely, don't count your chickens before they hatch.
No, I try to take things as they come.
Last of all, never say a thing you know in your heart is not true.
I won't.
Lying is a bad thing. It makes you sorry you were ever born, and not to have been born is a curse. You are condemned to live outside time, and when you live outside time, there is no day and night. You don't even get a chance to die.
I understand.
A lie can never be undone. Even the truth is not enough. I am a father, and I know about these things. Remember what happened to the father of our country? He chopped down the cherry tree, and then he said to his father, "I cannot tell a lie." Soon thereafter, he threw the coin across the river. These two stories are crucial events in American history. George Washington chopped down the tree, and then he threw away the money. Do you understand? He was telling us an essential truth, namely that money doesn't grow on trees. This is what made our country great, Peeta. Now George Washington's picture is on every dollar bill. There is an important lesson to be learned from all this.
I agree with you.
Of course, it's unfortunate that the tree was cut down. That tree was the tree of life, and it would have made us immune to death. Now we welcome death with open arms, especially when we are old. But the father of our country knew his duty. He could not do otherwise. That is the meaning of the phrase, "Life is a bowl of cherries." If the tree had remained standing, we would have had eternal life.
Yes, I see what you mean.
I have many such ideas in my head. My mind never stops. You were always a clever boy, Peeta, and I'm glad you understand.
I can follow you perfectly.
A father must always teach his son the lessons he has learned. In that way, knowledge is passed down from generation to generation, and we grow wise.
I won't forget what you've told me.
I'll be able to die happily now, Peeta.
I'm glad.
But you mustn't forget anything.
I won't, Father. I promise.
The next morning, Quinn was in front of the hotel at his usual time. The weather had finally changed. After 2 weeks of resplendent skies, a drizzle now fell on New York, and the streets were filled with the sound of wet moving tires. For an hour, Quinn sat on the bench, protecting himself with a black umbrella, thinking Stillman would appear at any moment. He worked his way through his roll and coffee, read the account of the Mets' Sunday loss, and still there was no sign of the old man. "Patience," he said to himself, and began to tackle the rest of the paper. 40 minutes passed.
He reached the financial section and was about to read an analysis of a corporate merger when the rain suddenly intensified. Reluctantly, he got up from his bench and removed himself to a doorway across the street from the hotel. He stood there in his clammy shoes for an hour and a half. Was Stillman sick? He wondered. Quinn tried to imagine him lying in his bed, sweating out a fever. Perhaps the old man had died during the night and his body had not yet been discovered. Such things happened, he told himself. Today was to have been the crucial day, and Quinn had made elaborate and meticulous plans for it. Now his calculations were for naught. It disturbed him that he had not taken this contingency into account. Still, he hesitated. He stood there under his umbrella, watching the rain slide off it in small, fine drops. By 11 o'clock, he had begun to formulate a decision. Half an hour later, he crossed the street, walked 40 paces down the block, and entered Stillman's hotel. The place stank of cockroach repellent and dead cigarettes. A few of the tenants, with nowhere to go in the rain, were sitting in the lobby, sprawled out on orange plastic chairs. The place seemed blank, a hell of stale thoughts. A large black man sat behind the front desk with his sleeves rolled up. One elbow was on the counter and his head was propped in his open hand. With his other hand, he turned the pages of a tabloid newspaper, barely pausing to read the words. He looked bored enough to have been there all his life. "I'd like to leave a message for one of your guests," Quinn said. The man looked up at him slowly, as if wishing him to disappear. "I'd like to leave a message for one of your guests," Quinn said again. "No guests here," said the man. "We call them residents." "For one of your residents, then, I'd like to leave a message." "And just who might that be, bub?"
"Stillman. Peter Stillman."
The man pretended to think for a moment, then shook his head.
"Nope. Can't recall anyone by that name."
"Don't you have a register?"
"Yeah, we've got a book, but it's in the safe."
"The safe? What are you talking about?"
"I'm talking about the book, bub. The boss likes to keep it locked up in the safe."
"I don't suppose you know the combination."
"Sorry, the boss is the only one."
Quinn sighed, reached into his pocket, and pulled out a $5 bill. He slapped it on the counter and kept his hand on top of it.
"I don't suppose you happen to have a copy of the book, do you?" he asked.
"Maybe," said the man.
"I'll have to look in my office."
The man lifted up the newspaper, which was lying open on the counter. Under it was the register.
"A lucky break," said Quinn, releasing his hand from the money. "Yeah, I guess today's my day," answered the man, sliding the bill along the surface of the counter, whisking it over the edge and putting it in his pocket.
"What did you say your friend's name was again?"
"Stillman, an old man with white hair. The gent in the overcoat?"
"That's right.
We call him the professor."
"That's the man. Do you have a room number?"
"He checked in about 2 weeks ago."
The clerk opened the register, turned the pages, and ran his finger down the column of names and numbers.
"Stillman," he said. "Room 303. He's not here anymore."
"What?"
"He checked out."
"What are you talking about?"
"Listen, bub, I'm only telling you what it says here. Stillman checked out last night. He's gone."
"That's the craziest thing I ever heard."
"I don't care what it is. It's all down here in black and white."
"Did he give a forwarding address?"
"Are you kidding?"
"What time did he leave?"
"Have to ask Louis, the night man. He comes on at 8.
"Can I see the room?"
"Sorry. I rented it myself this morning. The guy's up there asleep."
"What did he look like?"
"For $5, you've got a lot of questions."
"Forget it," said Quinn, waving his hand desperately. "It doesn't matter." He walked back to his apartment in a downpour, getting drenched in spite of his umbrella. So much for functions, he said to himself. So much for the meaning of words. He threw the umbrella onto the floor of his living room in disgust. Then he took off his jacket and flung it against the wall. Water splattered everywhere. He called Virginia Stillman, too embarrassed to think of doing anything else. At the moment she answered, he nearly hung up the phone.
I lost him, he said.
Are you sure?
He checked out of his room last night. I don't know where he is.
I'm scared, Paul.
Have you heard from him?
I don't know. I think so, but I'm not sure.
What does that mean?
Peter answered the phone this morning while I was taking my bath. He won't tell me who it was. He went into his room, closed the shades, and refuses to speak.
But he's done that before.
Yes, that's why I'm not sure. But it hasn't happened in a long time.
It sounds bad.
That's what I'm afraid of.
Don't worry. I have a few ideas. I'll get to work on them right away.
How will I reach you?
I'll call you every 2 hours, no matter where I am.
Do you promise?
Yes, I promise.
I'm so scared. I can't stand it.
It's all my fault. I made a stupid mistake, and I'm sorry.
No, I don't blame you. No one can watch a person 24 hours a day. It's impossible. You'd have to be inside his skin.
That's just the trouble. I thought I was.
It's not too late now, is it?
No. There's still plenty of time. I don't want you to worry.
I'll try not to.
Good. I'll be in touch.
Every 2 hours?
Every 2 hours.
He had finessed the conversation rather nicely. In spite of everything, he had managed to keep Virginia Stillman calm. He found it hard to believe, but she still seemed to trust him. Not that it would be of any help, for the fact was, he had lied to her. He did not have several ideas. He did not have even one. Chapter 10 Stillman was gone now. The old man had become part of the city. He was a speck, a punctuation mark, a brick in an endless wall of bricks. Quinn could walk through the streets every day for the rest of his life, and still he would not find him. Everything had been reduced to chance, a nightmare of numbers and probabilities. There were no clues, no leads, no moves to be made. Quinn backtracked in his mind to the beginning of the case. His job had been to protect Peter, not to follow Stillman. That had simply been a method, a way of trying to predict what would happen. By watching Stillman, the theory was that he would learn what his intentions were toward Peter. He had followed the old man for 2 weeks. What then could he conclude? Not much. Stillman's behavior had been too obscure to give any hints. There were, of course, certain extreme measures that they could take. He could suggest to Virginia Stillman that she get an unlisted telephone number. That would eliminate the disturbing calls, at least temporarily. If that failed, she and Peter could move. They could leave the neighborhood, perhaps leave the city altogether. At the very worst, they could take on new identities, live under different names. This last thought reminded him of something important. Until now, he realized, he had never seriously questioned the circumstances of his hiring. Things had happened too quickly, and he had taken it for granted that he could fill in for Paul Auster. Once he had taken the leap into that name, he had stopped thinking about Auster himself. If this man was as good a detective as the Stillmans thought he was, perhaps he would be able to help with the case. Quinn would make a clean breast of it. Auster would forgive him, and together they would work to save Peter Stillman. He looked through the yellow pages for the Auster Detective Agency. There was no listing. In the white pages, however, he found the name. There was one Paul Auster in Manhattan, living on Riverside Drive, not far from Quinn's own house. There was no mention of a detective agency, but that did not necessarily mean anything. It could be that Auster had so much work he didn't need to advertise. Quinn picked up the phone and was about to dial when he thought better of it. This was too important a conversation to leave to the phone. He did not want to run the risk of being brushed off. Since Oster did not have an office, that meant he worked at home. Quinn would go there and talk to him face to face. The rain had stopped now, and although the sky was still gray, far to the west, Quinn could see a tiny shaft of light seeping through the clouds. As he walked up Riverside Drive, he became aware of the fact that he was no longer following Stillman. It felt as though he had lost half of himself. For 2 weeks he had been tied by an invisible thread to the old man. Whatever Stillman had done, he had done. Wherever Stillman had gone, he had gone. His body was not accustomed to this new freedom, and for the first few blocks he walked at the old shuffling pace. The spell was over, and yet his body did not know it. Oster's building was in the middle of the long block that ran between 116th and 119th streets, just south of Riverside Church and Grant's Tomb. It was a well-kept place, with polished doorknobs and clean glass, and it had an air of bourgeois sobriety that appealed to Quinn at that moment. Oster's apartment was on the 11th floor, and Quinn rang the buzzer, expecting to hear a voice speak to him through the intercom. But the door buzzer answered him without any conversation. Quinn pushed the door open, walked through the lobby, and rode the elevator to the 11th floor. It was a man who opened the apartment door. He was a tall, dark fellow in his mid-30s with rumpled clothes and a two-day beard. In his right hand, fixed between his thumb and first two fingers, he held an uncapped fountain pen, still poised in a writing position. The man seemed surprised to find a stranger standing before him. "Yes?" he said tentatively. Quinn spoke in the politest tone he could muster. "Were you expecting someone else?" "My wife, as a matter of fact. That's why I rang the buzzer without asking who it was." "I'm sorry to disturb you," Quinn apologized. "But I'm looking for Paul Oster." "I'm Paul Oster," said the man. "I wonder if I could talk to you. It's quite important." "You'll have to tell me what it's about first." "I hardly know myself." Quinn gave Oster an earnest look. "It's complicated, I'm afraid. Very complicated." "Do you have a name?" "I'm sorry, of course I do. Quinn." "Quinn what?" "Daniel Quinn." The name seemed to suggest something to Oster, and he paused for a moment abstractedly, as if searching through his memory. "Quinn," he muttered to himself. "I know that name from somewhere." He went silent again, straining harder to dredge up the answer. "You aren't a poet, are you?"
"I used to be," said Quinn, "but I haven't written poems for a long time now."
"You did a book several years ago, didn't you? I think the title was Unfinished Business. A little book with a blue cover?"
"Yes, that was me."
"I liked it very much. I kept hoping to see more of your work. In fact, I even wondered what had happened to you."
"I'm still here, sort of."
Oster opened the door wider and gestured for Quinn to enter the apartment. It was a pleasant enough place inside. Oddly shaped, with several long corridors, books cluttered everywhere, pictures on the walls by artists Quinn did not know, and a few children's toys scattered on the floor. A red truck, a brown bear, a green space monster. Oster led him to the living room, gave him a frayed upholstered chair to sit in, and then went off to the kitchen to fetch some beer. He returned with two bottles, placed them on a wooden crate that served as the coffee table, and sat down on the sofa across from Quinn. "Was it some kind of literary thing you wanted to talk about?" Oster began.
"No," said Quinn. "I wish it was, but this has nothing to do with literature."
"With what, then?"
Quinn paused, looked around the room without seeing anything, and tried to start. "I have a feeling
there's been a terrible mistake. I came here looking for Paul Auster, the private detective.
The what?
Auster laughed. And in that laugh, everything was suddenly blown to bits. Quinn realized that he was talking nonsense. He might just as well have asked for Chief Sitting Bull. The effect would have been no different.
The private detective, he repeated softly.
I'm afraid you've got the wrong Paul Auster. You're the only one in the book.
That might be, said Auster, but I'm not a detective.
Who are you then? What do you do?
I'm a writer.
A writer?
Quinn spoke the word as though it were a lament.
I'm sorry, Auster said, but that's what I happen to be.
If that's true, then there's no hope. The whole thing is a bad dream.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Quinn told him.
He began at the beginning and went through the entire story step by step. The pressure had been building up in him since Stillman's disappearance that morning, and it came out of him now as a torrent of words. He told of the phone calls for Paul Auster, of his inexplicable acceptance of the case, of his meeting with Peter Stillman, of his conversation with Virginia Stillman, of his reading Stillman's book, of his following Stillman from Grand Central Station, of Stillman's daily wanderings of the carpet bag and the broken objects, of the disquieting maps that formed letters of the alphabet, of his talks with Stillman, of Stillman's disappearance from the hotel. When he had come to the end, he said,
"Do you think I'm crazy?"
No, said Auster, who had listened attentively to Quinn's monologue. If I had been in your place, I probably would have done the same thing. These words came as a great relief to Quinn, as if at long last the burden was no longer his alone. He felt like taking Auster in his arms and declaring his friendship for life.
You see, said Quinn, I'm not making it up. I even have proof.
He took out his wallet and removed the $500 check that Virginia Stillman had written 2 weeks earlier. He handed it to Auster.
You see, he said, it's even made out to you.
Auster looked the check over carefully and nodded. It seems to be a perfectly normal check.
Well, it's yours, said Quinn. I want you to have it.
I couldn't possibly accept it.
It's of no use to me.
Quinn looked around the apartment and gestured vaguely.
Buy yourself some more books, or a few toys for your kid.
This is money you've earned. You deserve to have it yourself.
Auster paused for a moment.
There's one thing I'll do for you, though. Since the check is in my name, I'll cash it for you. I'll take it to my bank tomorrow morning, deposit it in my account, and give you the money when it clears.
Quinn did not say anything.
All right? Auster asked. Is it agreed?
All right, said Quinn at last.
We'll see what happens. Auster put the check on the coffee table, as if to say the matter had been settled. Then he leaned back on the sofa and looked Quinn in the eyes. There's a much more important question than the check, he said. The fact that my name has been mixed up in this. I don't understand it at all.
This is the end of disc number 3. Please insert disc number 4.